Hey Conjurers, I'm Steph.
And I'm Sham.
Picture for a minute your dream vacation. Maybe it includes wild adventures or serene beaches. We all have that special fantasy we conjure up when the hard day's work gets to be a little too much and we long for a break. One family's dream vacation became a reality, but in a single moment it was transformed into a tragic nightmare. Arthur Doberal lived in Green Bay, Wisconsin with his wife, Jean, and their three children, 14-year-old Brian, 11-year-old Terry, and 7-year-old Renee. By 1961, at 40 years old, Arthur was a successful optometrist and had spent years saving up to take his family on his dream vacation. Ever since his service in World War II, when he had sailed through the Bahamas, he dreamed of living for a year on a sailboat traveling the open seas. That wasn't really an option, but he had saved enough money to take his family on a week-long sailing excursion from the Florida Keys to the Bahamas. Arthur and Jean decided to ditch the frigid Wisconsin winter and start their adventure in November 1961, leaving the option to extend their vacation longer if things were going well. The family traveled to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where they chartered a 60-foot yacht named the Bluebell, stationed at the Bahia Marmarita for $515. Arthur happened to know a local yachtsman from his military days and hired 44-year-old Julian Harvey to skipper the vessel for $100 per day. Julian brought along his sixth wife, 34-year-old aspiring writer Mary, as a cook for the trip. The family boarded the Bluebell around midday on Wednesday, November 8, 1961, and the ship was seen leaving port that very afternoon. Over the next 4 days, the family traveled to exotic locations throughout the Caribbean islands, where they purchased souvenirs and went on hiking and snorkeling adventures. On November 12th, at their final port before returning to Florida, Arthur visited the office of British District Commissioner Roderick Pinder to complete the paperwork needed to return to the U.S. During the exchange, Arthur stated, quote, "This has been a once-in-a-lifetime vacation. We'll be back here before Christmas," end quote. That evening, the two families shared a delicious meal and sat around on deck chatting and laughing together. Around 9 p.m., exhausted from the eventful week, 11-year-old Terry Jo went below deck to her sleeping cabin as the rest of her family and the Harveys remained on deck.
Okay, well, so far so good.
Yeah, sounds pretty nice.
Nothing crazy happening, but yeah. We are a true crime podcast.
Yeah. And their vacation's almost over, right?
They're going. I mean, it would suck now for something to happen at the end of their vacation.
I'm sorry to tell you.
Okay, let's get into it.
So the next day at approximately 12:30 p.m., a crew member aboard the oil tanker Gulf Lion observed a man waving frantically from a dinghy drifting in their direction and shouting, "Help, I have a dead baby on board." Pulling the man aboard, crew members observed the deceased body of a red-haired little girl wearing a little life jacket inside the dinghy, along with food, water, and other survival supplies. The man identified himself as Julian Harvey, the skipper of the ship Bluebell. Julian explained that the previous evening, his small vessel was hit by a sudden strong squall that caused the ship to rapidly keel over and the main mast to snap somewhere between the Apico Islands and Great Stirrup Cay. When the mast snapped, it injured the Doberalt family and his wife. It also pierced the ship's hull, causing a sudden fire. He attempted to rescue everyone, but the loose rigging blocked his access to them and the fire was spreading too quickly. He jumped in the dinghy and watched as the ship, his friends, and his wife sank slowly into the ocean.
I'm sorry, but I'd be dying with my family if that was the case.
You'd go down with the ship?
I would go down with the ship. Yeah.
Where's your survival instinct?
I want my children to survive more than I want to survive.
Yeah.
I feel like
he didn't have any kids on board. He was just the captain of the boat. He wasn't the father.
Oh, shoot. Okay. Sorry. I confused them.
No, it's good. It's a good clarification. We don't really know these people yet.
Okay, but he still knew them.
Yeah, he was like military buddies with the dad.
Okay, and there's children on board.
Yes.
So I would...
Anyone's children, I would...
I would run through fire to grab those children. But, okay, I get it. I mean, he's not the dad, so I'll give him a pass.
He did just abandon his wife there, though.
Oh, he did abandon his wife. Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Okay, I have
he couldn't get to her, though.
I have my doubts.
Okay. So, while floating in the ocean, a short time later, he spotted the body of 7-year-old Renee floating by. He pulled her from the water and attempted to revive her, but it was useless. He kept her body with him anyway, out of respect. An autopsy later revealed Renee had drowned. Julian was immediately questioned by authorities, and they had some serious doubts about his story. His calm demeanor and the various survival supplies he had somehow had time to pack into the dinghy before escaping the sinking ship just didn't add up. But in the end, they couldn't actually disprove his story, so they let him return to Miami on November 15th.
So he already had the dinghy locked and loaded and ready to go.
Yeah, he had water, food, and, like, lots of other supplies. So if it was
unexpected, so he had time to run to the kitchen, grab some water, some Doritos.
Maybe he's super prepared and already had it stocked. I don't know.
Okay.
So 3 days after Julian was rescued, a crew member of a Greek freighter observed something odd in the distance. He had been scanning the waters of the Northwest Providence Channel, a strait that divides two major islands of the Bahamas, and one of the thousands of tiny dancing whitecaps in the distance caught the officer's eye. Among the hundreds of other boats in the channel, he focused on that single dot and realized it was too large to be a piece of debris, but far too small to be a boat that would travel that far out to sea. He convinced the captain to change course, and when they got close, they realized it was a small white raft carrying a young child who was waving feebly. The freighter stopped, and the child was lifted aboard. The child was severely sunburned, dehydrated, and incoherent, but she was able to identify herself as Terry Jo Duperrault before falling into a coma. A rescue helicopter was brought in, and she was airlifted to a Miami hospital in critical condition.
Okay, so at least we have a survivor. You know, and I'm sure she went through a lot of trauma. I cannot imagine floating in the sea as a child.
Right?
I mean, I can't imagine floating in the sea as an adult. But at least she survived. I hope she has something, you know, something to tell them, maybe. Maybe she witnessed him throw Doritos in the little raft before he decided to go off to sea.
Well, she's currently in a coma, so she wasn't talking to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, but when she wakes up, she wakes up, I hope she has some things to say about Mr. Julian.
Well, the media went wild for the story of the 11-year-old girl who survived nearly 4 days on a tiny little raft, not even big enough for her to lay down. She had no food, no water. She was baking in the sun during the day and shivering in the cold at night. All the while, sharks circled, just waiting for her to give up. But Terry didn't give up. Every day on that little raft, she prayed and clung to life with everything she had. Even now, barely alive after what she endured, she continued to fight to survive. The international media started calling her the sea orphan, which is kind of harsh, but
yeah, I think it's true. It's a little weird.
It's a little crass, but you know, okay.
I guess it's not mean per se. They are praising her, so I wouldn't call her that, but
right. You know. 5 days later, Terry Jo regained consciousness, and the story she told was very different from that told by Julian Harvey. Terry told authorities that on the night of November 12th, she had gone to bed before the rest of her family. In the middle of the night, Terry Jo was startled awake by her brother yelling, "Help, Daddy, help!" She also heard brief running and stomping noises from above, then silence. She looked around, but her little sister Renee, who was sharing the cabin with her, had never come to bed that night. After about 5 minutes of fearful indecision, Terry Jo crept out of her cabin. She saw her mother and brother lying crumpled in a pool of blood in the main cabin, which functioned as a kitchen and a dining room during the day and was converted into a bedroom at night. She knew instantly they were dead. Cautiously, Terry Jo climbed the stairs and stuck her head out of the hatch. She saw more blood pooled on the deck, and possibly a knife. She climbed out and turned toward the front of the boat. Suddenly, Captain Julian slapped her and shoved her down the stairs as he yelled, "Get back down there!" Terry Jo ran back to her cabin and crawled back into her bed. Then she heard sloshing. Oily water started seeping into her cabin, covering the floor. Terry Jo realized the ship was sinking. Suddenly, she saw the captain's dark form in the cabin's doorway. He had a rifle, and he aimed it at her for several long moments before turning and walking out of the room. With water now splashing over the top of her mattress, Terry Jo knew she had to abandon the cabin. Wading through waist-deep water to the stairs, she climbed to the top again. At the top, she saw the ship's dinghy and rubber life raft were floating beside the boat. She yelled to Captain Julian, "Is the ship sinking?" "Yes," Julian shouted back as he pushed the line to the dinghy into her hands. "Hold this," he demanded.
Okay.
Scared.
This man is bold. Right? He's like, "Yes, it's sinking. I need you to help me survive. Yes, I've murdered your entire family, but here, just hold this.
Hold this for a minute."
Oh, I don't like him. I don't like him one bit.
Girl, scared and confused, Terry Jo let the line slip through her fingers. The dinghy slowly started drifting away from the sinking Bluebell. Julian jumped overboard to catch it. Terry Jo watched him swim after the dinghy as he disappeared into the night.
He should have disappeared into the sea, like deep. Just start drowning. That's what he deserves. he's horrible.
We'll get into speculation in a little bit, but if she hadn't have dropped the line, do you think he would have taken her with him?
No.
No, he would have murdered
her. No. He probably said it like gleefully. She's like, "Is the ship sinking?" And he's like, "Yes." Like, that's how I imagine it. Just pure evil. No, he was going to leave that little girl on the ship to die with the rest of her family.
He might have planned to, like, murder her like he did the rest of the family. But he didn't have a chance because he had to jump after his little boat.
Yeah, but then why would he take her knowing that she knows what she knows?
See, I don't think he was ever going to take her. I just don't think he was planning to leave her alive either.
That's true. Okay, well, but that makes sense. So you think he was going to get into the boat or kill her right before he got into the boat?
I think he needed her to hold on to the boat so he could finish something up. And then he was going to, like, stab her and take the boat.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair.
Total speculation.
That's fair. Who knows what goes through this man's brain? Okay, so now we know the truth. Mm-hmm. Terry, you know, let it out. She told everybody what happened. What the fuck is happening to Julian now?
Well, on November 17th, we're going to back up a little bit.
Okay.
Terry was still in a coma. The U.S. Coast Guard brought Julian in for a second interview. He reiterated his story that a sudden squall had brought down the Bluebell's mast, slashing a hole in the ship's hull, rupturing the auxiliary gas tank, and starting a fire. The circumstances of which made it impossible for him to rescue his wife or any member of the DuPont family. Julian again claimed he had found Renee's body floating in the water and that he had tried unsuccessfully to revive the child. Midway through the conversation, he was informed that Terry Jo had been rescued the previous day and that her condition was improving. His response was to exclaim, "Oh my God," before quickly and calmly adding, "Isn't that wonderful?" Lieutenant Ernest Murdoch then informed Julian that an official investigation into the loss of the Bluebell and her passengers was going to be launched that very day. Shortly thereafter, Julian asked to be excused from further questioning, claiming that he was tired and that he wished to speak with his wife's grieving family. His request was granted. They had no reason not to at that point.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously nervous that everything is about to come out and that they're going to find out that, you know, he's the one that slashed a hole into the ship and ruptured the auxiliary gas tank. It's all going to come out. And left his
wife. And he knows that Terry Jo survived.
Yeah.
Even though she was still in a coma at that point.
He still knows it's going to come out. Yeah, it's going to come out. He knew it was over.
So Julian drove to the Sandman Motel a short distance away.
Oh, gosh.
He checked in under a fake name, John Monroe.
Don't say it.
Paying cash for a room. He then wrote a 2-page suicide note before slashing his thigh, ankles, and a jugular vein with a razor blade in the motel bathroom.
What a coward.
Right?
Like, I mean, he took the easy way out.
He couldn't face the consequences of his actions.
No. Ugh. I hate when this happens. I hate it.
I know. His body was found by a maid 2 hours later. The suicide note addressed to a close friend from his days in the Marines was found on a dresser in the room. The note didn't provide any explanations or apologies for his actions, but simply ended with the words, quote, "I got too tired and nervous. I couldn't stand it any longer." The note also requested the recipient take care of his 14-year-old son, Lance, and that he was to be buried at sea. Given such clear evidence of foul play from the sole survivor of the Bluebell and Julian's subsequent suicide, an investigation was launched into Julian's history. The inquiry revealed Julian was a decorated World War II veteran and Korean War pilot. He had difficulty holding a job for any length of time and had serious financial problems. It also showed he had recently arranged a double indemnity insurance policy on the life of his wife.
They always do.
Just 2 months after their marriage earlier that summer. Setting him up to collect $20,000 if she died accidentally.
Red flag. Red flag. If your spouse tries to set up life insurance for you, I would say within 6 months of being married. Like, it's one, like, you should just have life insurance, you know. But for your spouse to, like, say, hey, I want to set that up, it's like, we just got together. I mean, not just got together. We just married.
Why are you thinking about that?
Why are you already thinking about collecting dollars off of me? Red flag.
Well, girl, searching further into Julian's background, investigators discovered he had previously survived a 1949 car accident that had killed his second wife and her mother. The crash occurred when the car he had been driving plunged off a bridge at high speed into a bayou on a rainy night, after which he had swam to safety, leaving his wife, Joanne, and her mother, Myrtle, to drown.
Oh, so he's just surviving all of
this.
This
was not his first time.
Cars, the ships. No, he's an expert at surviving.
On another occasion, one of his ships had also previously sunk after running into a submerged wreckage of the warship San Marcos, which had sunk in 1911 in shallow water within Chesapeake Bay. Crew members on board had repeatedly warned Julian to steer his ship clear of the wreckage, but he had repeatedly navigated his vessel close to the prohibited site, claiming to his crew's passengers that he was attempting to read an inscription upon a buoy marking the site. His powerboat also sunk under suspicious circumstances off the coast of Cuba in 1958. All these losses and tragedies had yielded large insurance settlements from which he had financially benefited.
So this is a full-time job for him.
He's a insurance scam artist.
This is, he's like, okay, so one thing has sunk, on to the next. On to the next tragedy. Oh my gosh, I've never heard of somebody doing something like this. I mean, it's not normal, but I mean, you know, I've never
heard. It happens, but he got real creative about it.
Yeah, this is like multiple times. You would think the insurance company would be like, okay, bro, like, this is like the fifth time.
You should be more careful.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I would definitely be suspicious if I was the insurance company. I mean, they keep track of how many tickets you get, you know? They should be keeping track of this.
Well, the investigation concluded that Julian's wife, Mary, had most likely been the intended victim, and he'd planned to kill her during the voyage and make it look like she had been lost at sea, using the Depperault family as witnesses to corroborate his story. Unfortunately, he may have been caught in the act by a member of the family and had been forced to kill them all and sink the ship to cover his tracks. But Terry Jo survived, and he knew he would never get away with what he had done. In closure, the inquiry concluded that had Julian Harvey not committed suicide, he would have been prosecuted for the murder of all of those who had died aboard the Bluebell and the attempted murder of Terry Jo.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly why he committed suicide. So he would not have to deal with the consequences of his actions. Okay, so what about our survivor? How is little Terry Jo doing?
Yeah, so following the loss of her family, Terry Jo returned to Green Bay to live with her father's sister and her three cousins. She refused to throw out the blouse and slacks that she was wearing at the time of her rescue. Due to the stigma of psychological coping strategies in the early 1960s, authority figures very seldom spoke with Terry Jo about her ordeal, and she received no trauma counseling at all. She refused to be seen as a victim, though, and simply picked herself up and carried on. Later, she married and had three children. As an adult, she chose to live and work close to the ocean. Terry Jo didn't speak publicly about the loss of her family and her survival ordeal for over 20 years, until at 38 years old, in 1988, she appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show, where she was reunited with the captain of the Greek freighter that had rescued her. In 2010, she released her memoir, Alone, Orphaned on the Ocean, co-authored by psychologist and survival expert Richard Logan. The book details her family's final cruise, Julian's murder of her family and his wife, and the 3.5 days she spent drifting upon the Cork float prior to her rescue, and her life in the years since. Many have speculated as to why Julian didn't murder Terry Jo while still on the Bluebell, like we had talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he subconsciously wanted to be caught and punished for his actions. Maybe some people thought so. Maybe something about Terry Jo touched him. I don't know. We'll never know for sure. However, Terry Jo and others have theorized that Julian had actually intended to kill her, but when she accidentally dropped the rope connecting his dinghy, he was forced to dive overboard in order to prevent its floating away without him, and thus left her alone and alive on the sinking ship, believing she couldn't possibly survive and would simply go down with the ship.
That's fair.
That's what I think he probably planned to do as well.
Yeah, he definitely was not planning on taking her, though.
No. In a 2010 TV interview with Matt Lauer, Terry Jo stated she doesn't wish for people to reflect upon her ordeal and think, gee, that poor little girl, but rather to think to themselves, look how she has gone on with her life. Terry Jo has also stated, quote, I always believed I was saved for a reason. If even one person heals from a life tragedy after reading my story, my journey will have been worth it, end quote. One man's selfish plot to murder his wife for insurance money led to the tragedy of nearly an entire family. What should have been the vacation of a lifetime became Terry Jo's living nightmare. Julian will never face the justice he deserves, but in the end, he didn't get away with his terrible crimes either. Terry Jo is truly a testament to the endurance of the human spirit in so many ways. We could all learn something from the little girl who survived being attacked at sea by her own captain.
There is an epidemic of personal and social issues, including addiction, chronic disease, anxiety, depression, PTSD, and even more whose roots can all be traced to trauma, adverse childhood experiences, chronic stress, and ultimately nervous system dysregulation. In the last number of years, there has been groundbreaking research in neuroscience that has fundamentally changed our understanding of how trauma can impact individuals psychologically, physiologically, emotionally, and socially. The Trauma Foundation is focused on making this work more accessible by developing and directly supporting programs, initiatives, and research focused on trauma recovery. They do this by treatment, training, clinician scholarship programs, and research. To donate to this organization or seek help, go to thetraumafoundation.org.
To view images, information, and sources from this case, visit our website at crimeandconjure.com. Research and writing for this episode was done by Stefan Sham. Editing of this episode by Denver Fortner Productions with music by Jordan Elena. Be sure to check out our Instagram at Crime and Conjure Podcast for our question of the week. You can also find us on TikTok.
Steph, what's our conjure tip of the week?
The ocean has always felt magical to me. I love the smell of the water, the rhythmic crash of the waves, and the breeze that brushes my cheek as I feel the sand under my feet. Many people collect seashells, myself included, and you can actually make your own rune set with the shells you collect. All you need is a permanent marker or paint and a collection of seashells. Once you have your shells, look up the rune symbols you wish to use and draw one symbol on the smooth side of each shell. Do this intuitively. Trust that each shell you select is the right one for the symbol you're drawing on it. Traditionally, 24 of your shells will have symbols and one will remain blank. Use your runes for divination and keep them wrapped in a cloth when not in use.
I mean, summer is right around the corner, so this might be one of the best tips to just, like, put into play for you guys.
Yes. I mean, we're pretty lucky that we live close to the ocean, but hopefully everyone will get to the ocean at some point.
Just take a road trip. Go to the coast.
Yes, yes.
Wherever you're at. Until next time, stay vigilant, conjurers.